Welcome to the Mustang Owners Podcast. And now your host, Steve Hall.
Welcome to another episode of the Mustang Owners Podcast. Today we're joined by, this gentleman is actually a car guy's car guy. There's really not much in the car world he hasn't, I don't know how to say this, has seen, touched, feel, worked on, driven, and all, we're talking about all types of cars, not just Mustangs. And I'm sure we'll get to a point where we'll focus on Mustangs a little bit. I'd like to introduce Tom Cotter.
Thanks, Steve. I was looking forward to this.
Well, we are too. Actually, I have to be honest with you. I did a little homework. We've met a couple of times in chat and got to know each other a little bit. But your YouTube videos, which are great, really tells a lot about Tom Cotter. It really kind of shows, you know, just the level of car interest. And as you mentioned earlier, quite all consuming. So I'm just kind of curious if we just start a little bit before I do, of course, have some Mustang related topics. But what got you started with the YouTube area? I mean, that's obviously been out for a while, but obviously you do quite a bit in that area. So I thought maybe you kind of give our listeners a little start of how that started.
Well, the first book I wrote was the Holman & Moody story, and that was 22 years ago. And then I was looking for another subject to write about, like, all right, maybe another famous race team or whatever. And I was talking to my publisher, and I had just driven back from California in my Cobra. I had purchased a 289 Cobra, and one of the Road and Track editors that everybody loves, Peter Egan, he rode with me, and he wrote a great story about driving, you know, this two-seater iconic car from California to North Carolina. And it was in an issue of Road and Track, and that resulted in a phone call from a neighbor of mine who I'd never met, but we share a property line. We live in the country, and you know, we share a fence line, but you know, his house is a half mile away. And so he said, you know, my name is Hugh Barger, and I'm your neighbor, and I love the story about driving a Cobra across the United States that was in Road and Track. I have a car in my garage that's related to the Cobra. You might want to see it. So, wow. So I've been driving past this guy's barn. It's a farm, you know, it had 500 acres. I've been driving past his barn for 20 years at that point. Like, wow, what do you have in there? You know, you can always imagine maybe it's something really cool. So I went over there that Saturday, and he looked at my Cobra and admitted that he was a lifelong Cobra enthusiast, and then brought me into his barn, and he had an AC Greyhound. So I have an AC Cobra, which is an open two-seater V8, and he had an AC Greyhound, which is a closed aluminum body car that resembles the Cobra somewhat, but it's a coupe and it's a four-seater. His father gave it to him when he went to graduate school, and he used it during graduate school. And then because they made so few Greyhounds in the AC factory, he needed a wheel cylinder or a mass cylinder or something, and it was unobtainium. That was it. Couldn't get it. So he parked it in the barn, which is where it was 20 years ago, which is where it still is today. It's probably been in that barn since the early 70s, so probably 50 years. And so I had a phone call with my publisher that afternoon. And I said, Lee, you'll never guess what happened. I mean, you know, the guy liked my Cobra story, and he had a car literally next door to my house in a barn. You know, it's a half mile away, but it's my neighbor next door. He had a car built at the same little factory in England that built my Cobra, but it's a barn, you know, the word barn find hadn't even been used at that point. And he said, Tom, that's your next book. I said, what do you mean? He said, Finding Old Cars, the Cobra in the Barn. I said, I don't know. Do you think anybody wants to read about that? Well, since then, I've written 11 books on barn finds. Cobra in the Barn, Hemi in the Barn, Vincent in the Barn, Hemi in the Harley in the Barn, 50 Shades of Rust, Barn Find Road Trip, Route 66 Barn Find Road Trip, Motor City Barn Find Road Trip. I mean, just on and on. And so I got a call from Haggerty, because the books did, in fact, have an audience. And this lady, Claire Walters from Haggerty, called me and said, Tom, we think that your book format would suit itself pretty well to be on a YouTube program, a regular YouTube program. And I said, boy, I don't know. I've already talked to Discovery Channel and independent producers and all these people that contacted me. They all had that same idea, but they wanted me to be somebody I wasn't. And in that, I mean, if you turn on Motor Trend is people with attitudes and lots of tattoos and throwing wrenches, and they have to beep out their language because of, you know, foul language. And I said, Claire, I don't want to be anybody but me. And she said, that's all we want. We want you to be you. And so we decided to give it a shot with a pilot program, and we stumbled through it and worked. And now here I am 7 years later. And you know, I've done, I don't know. I mean, I think I have approaching 2 million subscribers. And some of my programs, the more popular ones where I find Cobras and Ferraris and stuff, have like 4 million views. And so that's how it began. It was almost by accident, and it worked out well. And so I find myself in yet another new career at this late stage of my life.
Sometimes that's actually how it works out. You know, obviously right place, right time. But the image I had of Tom Cotter with tattoos, that just doesn't really resonate. So I can appreciate that thought. I mean, that's what you say out there. There is a lot of video out there, but it is about attitude and trying to bring something else to another. I guess you want to say that's what some people think is cool, where car guys just want to see about the cars. Key is, and that's something that we always do here at the museum, is the car is the star. That's really what we're, you know, what people come here to see. And the same way, I'm sure, it appears that you look at it the same way when you do your videos. You're here to talk about cars and people who own the cars. And the biggest thing, of course, is the stories. Like I said, I had a chance to look at a couple of the videos that you've done, and you get caught up in it because you want to hear the story. You would like to see the people, the cars, and a lot of interesting cars. In fact, you own quite a few interesting cars. And I thought before we get to Mustangs, just if you don't mind, just tell us a little bit about some of your cars, if you don't mind.
Well, I have owned and still own some pretty significant cars. The one is the Cobra we just talked about. I have a 289 Cobra, the 490th built, that I drove across the United States 22 years ago. And since then, it's been in, you know, it's probably been in 30 states because I do Cobra tours every year. It's been to Alaska. It's been broken into by a bear who wanted to get the Fig Newtons that I forgot to take out of the car. Rip the roof off. That's 490th Cobra built. I also have the 490th 66 GT350 built, which is a Hertz car. It's white with gold, and it's such a great car to drive. I mean, of all the cars I have, it's the nicest driving car. I'd rather take a long trip in that car. I would jump at that more than other cars. I have my Ford inventory? I mean, I have my 39 Woody Wagon that I bought one in 1969 when I was 15. And that's kind of my co-star in the Barn Find Hunter program. I'm really a Ford guy, but that doesn't stop me from owning, well, a Chevy. I actually race a 64 Corvette fuel-injected roadster in vintage racing because it's affordable to race a Corvette. You can buy a Corvette with lots of cool racing history and maintain it easily for one-tenth the amount of money it would take to race a Cobra, to buy a racing Cobra. So, like, you know, Corvette doesn't run quite as fast as the Cobra, but it runs just fine for me. I have a Chrysler Hemi-powered car, and it's probably the most significant car I will ever own. It's a Cunningham C3, one of 25 Vignali body Cunninghams built by a great guy named Briggs Cunningham in West Palm Beach, Florida, with Hemi engine, with four carburetors and a Cadillac transmission. And then that chassis was sent to tour in Italy, and Vignali built a body out of aluminum. And so that was a significant car built in 1952. And somehow the stars aligned, and I found one in a basement in Greenville, South Carolina. And, you know, I'm more proud of owning that car than any other car. I could always buy another Cobra or Shelby. I could never buy another Cunningham. And then I really dig British cars. I'm restoring a Lotus Elan right now, which has got a kind of a Ford-based engine, twin cam engine, but the bottom end is all Ford. I just sold my MGTD after 35 years of ownership. I raced my Morris Minor. It's sitting in a warehouse right now, which sounds like an oxymoron, racing a Morris Minor. It doesn't seem to make much sense, but it was a blast. I have a supercharged Volkswagen Beetle with a Judson supercharger on it. So it's 36 horsepower engine. Is now pumped up to 50 horsepower. which is about the same as some powerful John Deere lawn tractors. I have a recently sold, I mean, it killed me to sell it, but I had to, a 67 Ford Country Squire, kind of a ratty patina, rusty finish, but it had a, the only one ever built with a 428 cubic inch engine with a four-speed transmission. So think about that, a Country Squire with a four-speed manual gearbox, bucket seats, and a console. And so that was a ton of fun to own. And let's see, what else do I have in the garage? I have a 53 Ford two-door station wagon I bought in high school for $85, and I still have that. And I'm sure that, you know, my daily driver is an F-150. That's about it at the moment. So, I've had up to 40 cars at one time. At one time, I had 14 Woodies alone. But then I I went to therapy and decided I didn't need 14 Woodies. And so I'm trying to thin down my cars, because I'm telling everybody listening to this podcast right now, owning a lot of cars seems like fun from a distance. But when you own a lot of cars, it's not fun. If you want to take, that car in the corner over there, I want to take it out and drive on a Saturday morning. Well, you've got to move the other two cars in front of it. And they have flat tires, and their gas has gone bad, and the battery's dead, and you wind up spending a half a day moving the cars that you didn't want to drive just so you can get to the car that you want to drive. There's insurance issues. It sounds like fun, but it's not fun. Unless you're like Jay Leno and have a team of mechanics that can keep them all operating, and he takes a different car home every night, keeps them all lubricated and running. But at the moment, I probably said, use too many words to tell you what I have, but that's what I have at the moment.
Obviously, it's also being that a lot of what you do is barn find and searching and looking for cars. And it must be difficult as you find some of these cars and you spend some time with the owner and maybe hear the story. There may be an opportunity where you're looking at this car and you're saying, maybe I'd like to have that car. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, it's almost like you're you're ground zero by going and looking for these kind of cars to show on the YouTube. But at the same time, as a collector or as a car guy, you kind of put yourself in harm's way to say, wow, I want that car. You become a person. I can see myself become very infatuated with a car very easily. And then the next thing you know, like you said, you could have 30, 40 cars and you're going, well, what do I do with them now? My wife has one rule. I'm allowed to have any one Mustang I want. The key word there is one. That's it. That's who controls my appetite for cars and such. Well, let's talk a little bit about some Mustangs, if you don't mind. Obviously, I'm sure through your searches and tours and things, you've probably run across some Mustangs. And so I'm hoping you might just share a couple different Mustangs that you've come across that, these are the kind of stories I'm sure our listeners are looking forward to hearing a little bit more about. So hopefully you can just share a few with us.
Well, I want to go way, way, way back to, I was 10 years old. It was 1964, and I was in fourth grade, and, there was all this hoopla, and I kind of was conscious of it, this hoopla at Ford dealerships about this car, and they had paper on the windows of Ford dealerships all over the country. So there was this new car coming out, but it was top secret and whatever. I'm a lifelong PR guy. That's my career was in the PR business. And to build hype like that over a consumer product is like every PR person dreams of the opportunity to do that. Well, under Lee Iacocca, Ford was able to do that. So when the Mustang was introduced, two teachers in my school on the same day received their new Mustang. Well, not two teachers, the janitor and a sixth grade teacher. The janitor got a green coupe, four-speed, hypo 289 Mustang, 64 and a half. And a sixth grade teacher got a black Mustang convertible, white top. I don't remember the color of the interior, automatic 289. And it was such a big deal at my school. Now, I'm in fourth grade. I'm starting to learn, times tables and stuff. And they allowed teachers to bring their classes, the students, out to the parking lot so we could look at these new Mustangs up close. And, to this day, I remember I was so excited because I'm a car kid. I loved cars. And here, the teacher was allowing the classes to go out and look at these cars. Like, when did that ever happen? And I wonder how that could happen today. You know, what kind of car would have to be put in the parking lot for teachers, the principal to allow teachers to bring their classes out there? I can't think of it. So that was an amazing moment for me. Soon thereafter, my father took us. I grew up on Long Island. He took my brother and I to the New York World's Fair. And there was this Ford Pavilion, and you got to sit in a Ford convertible. And I got to see another Mustang convertible. And I wanted to get in that convertible to ride through on this fantasy ride through the future. But sadly, the Mustang was one car ahead of, and other people got in there. So we got into a Galaxy convertible, which was fine. But I got to, you know, be up close to a Mustang again. My Uncle Bob, who lived in Boston, had a Mustang coupe. It was probably a 65, and he never garaged it. So it was always dull paint, was red. I think Rangoon red. And he'd come down and visit us once in a while. And he went off to church on a Sunday morning, and I decided I was going to wax his car. So I compounded, waxed it, and it's so amazing. I remember to this day, he got home from church. He borrowed my mother's Volkswagen, and he says, "Tommy, it looks like $1 million." And so I got to spend, you know, hands-on time with a Mustang. And then, you know, to me, it's always been this car that came out during a happy time. I know the Vietnam War was raging, but America was a different place, and there wasn't so much animosity towards neighbors. And when I see a Mustang, I think of happy days, not the show, but a happy time. And I look at my GT350, white with gold stripes, and it just makes me feel... Well, it makes me feel like I'm, you know, 10 or 12 years old again, but it just has such a look. If I look at it from the 3/4 rear end shot, fastback, those nice little taillights, the gold stripes coming down, it just, wow, they got it right. They got it so right that, you know, here we are coming up on 60 years later after the car was introduced, and it just looks so right. So I've owned a couple of Mustangs in my life. I owned a 69 convertible, which was really oddly optioned. I got it for $400. It was a 69 convertible, burgundy black top, like a burgundy interior, 3-speed manual, 351 Windsor, I think, with a, you know, roll up windows and factory air conditioning. Like, what an odd combination of 3-speed manual, factory air. Just odd. But yeah, you know, I bought that, owned it for a little while, but I could never afford the car. When I was a kid, I couldn't afford to keep cars. I had to move them on and try to make a little profit and keep moving. Mustangs I've found, you know, on Barn Find Hunter, you know, you say about the stories, I would rather find one car, even a boring car. It can be a, you know, a Chevy Nova or a Ford Fairlane. I'd rather find one car with a good story than a field worth 1,500 cars, you know, because fields of cars or junkyards don't have stories. They have inventory. But a person who owns a car has a story. And that's what I strive to kind of dig out on Barn Find Hunter, is dig that story out and have the owner tell me that, well, I got that in high school. My aunt gave it to me when I graduated. I drove it to college. And, you know, I got married and I went to the hospital in this car. I got had my baby delivered. I mean, that's something we can all relate to. That's what I pursue on my program. And I've found a lot of Mustangs on the program, but I've found a lot of other cars. People will write, you know, comments to my YouTube program and why don't you find more GTXs? I like 440 GTXs. Why don't you find more Yanko Camaros? You know, let's get real. I can't decide what I'm going to find. When I open a barn door, garage door, it is what it is. I'm lucky that there's a car in there. You know, I raise the door and it could be a rusty Falcon, but there's a car in there. I can't decide what kind of car I'm going to find. And if your listeners think that you can do that, it's incorrect. You know, it's sad that American Pickers is not as authentic a show as you believe it is. You watch it and you think that they're going to, oh my God, look at this car. It's amazing. But they knew that car was in there 2 months before they ever got there. They had people, you know, search crews go out there, and if they're going to buy it, they negotiate the price ahead of time. And then Joe and Frank, you know, Frank and whatever his name, Mike, show up and they, oh, look at this. Wow, aren't we lucky? Nah, they're not lucky. So I try to keep it authentic. And when I open the barn door, the garage door, walk in the backyard, whatever it is, the car, it is what it is. And the brand of car doesn't matter. The story does.
And that's one of the things I think is really unique about barn finds is, like you said, when you go to a barn and you open the door, it's almost like a Christmas present, so to speak. You're going to unwrap, by opening the door, you're unwrapping that gift, as it were, and you don't know what you're going to find. It could be anything in there. It could be something, you know, some kind of a Shelby or a Mustang or a Camaro at the same time, or it could be like Al Capone's safe, empty, nothing there kind of a thing. So it is definitely just kind of, it's just one of those things. And it's unfortunate, though, that so many people do watch reality shows and they think, wow, you know, I just got to go find some barns and I'll find all this good stuff. It doesn't really work that way, as you said. It's really, it's rare to find a car in a barn. It's not as simple as it is, because a lot of people who have barns know they have a car in there, and they may have already decided to, you know, restore it, sell it, do something with it. So it's hard to, find something these days, extremely hard, and much less to find something that that's a car-wise that you can then, of course, create a show and really kind of spend some time with and get the story from the owner. So it's not as simple. I'm sure you have, as they say, my dad and I used to fish a lot. And he said, you're going to have more days when you don't catch fish than you do catch fish. And that's just how it is sometimes. Sometimes you're able to find it, and sometimes you're not. So, well, I'm hoping, again, I'm going to kind of go pin you down a little bit, maybe more to Mustang. Was there any one Mustang that you found in a barn or on your tours that really just kind of stood out to you because of the story with the owner that you could share?
Well, yeah, this is one that has not been broadcast and may not be broadcast. I'm not sure, but I was doing research for a book on racing Porsches. And once I got into the book, I decided it was too statistical and, okay, this is not the book for me. So after spending, several months working on a book, I decided to shelve it. But there was a name that kept on cropping up when I read through race results from Sebring and Bridgehampton racetracks. There was a name that kept popping up. And it was curious to me because, this name, it was two brothers. It turned out being two brothers. And they raced a car called an HRG, and they raced a car called, a Porsche. And I'd see them, their name pop up here and there and here and there. And they were very active racers in the early to mid-50s. And they came from a town just a couple of miles from where I grew up on Long Island. I said, son of a gun. And so I'd see it more and more and more. So I called a friend of mine in that town who owns a furniture store. I said, Bill, have you ever heard of this name? He said, no, but I'll do some research. So anyway, he did some research, found out that the son of one guy and the nephew of the other guy lived in the town still, and he was a car guy, and he couldn't wait to talk to me. So here's the ultimate fantasy, is that you do research, find a family like this, and the son of a gun, the father's 550 Porsche Spyder is still in the garage, this many years later. And so I said, wow, I wonder. So I get the son on the phone. I talk to him. I said, by chance, might your father's or uncle's Porsche still be in the family, like in your garage? He said, no, sadly, they sold those cars in the 50s. But, and I love the but, he said, I'm a car guy and I've raced and I've still got a bunch of old cars. I said, really? He says, yeah, I got a 911 sitting in the building. I haven't used it in 40 years. And I've got a 914-6 that I haven't used in years. And I've got my Shelby Mustang. And what? You have a Shelby? Yep. Well, tell me about it. So he said, well, I bought a GT350, 66. And I converted it to a race car. And I raced it for years. I've raced it at Bridgehampton and Lime Rock and Summit Point and Briar, New Hampshire, and on and on. And I said, and you still have this car? He said, yeah, I do. And so he started to tell me about it. And it hadn't been out of the garage since, probably the late 80s. And I have yet to make a trip back there to meet him in person. But I spent a long time on the phone with him when we enjoyed each other's company. What I'm getting around to is, this is a Mustang-centric program, and I understand that. But by looking for a Porsche that might still exist in a family's garage, I found a Shelby Mustang. So I think it's an important lesson for your listeners to take away is that, you know, you may be hunting for one kind of car and stumble across another. I was hunting for, you know, a possibly a rare Porsche racing car because I had read about it in race results and stumbled into a GT350 Shelby with racing history that's still sitting in a guy's garage. It's been there since the 80s, not out of the garage. And so, you know, they're still out there. And I just want to say that at Amelia Island, just 2 weeks ago, I introduced a new book, and it should be on Amazon right now, called Secrets of the Barn Find Hunter. And I wrote it, and McKeel Haggerty wrote the introduction to it about him finding his first Porsche when he was 14 years old or whatever. And in that book, I explain how I started to hunt for cars as a 12-year-old on Long Island. I mean, like, I grew up on Long Island, and I would look for cars out the school window on the way home from school and then go back on the weekend with my bicycle and talk to the owner. I mean, I was 12. I didn't have any money, but I started to hunt for cars that early. My first car was a 1940 Ford convertible that I bought for $25 because Lumpy on Leave It to Beaver had one on the TV program, and I just dug that car. It was so cool. So what I'm saying is there are plenty of cars out there, and the secret is tell everybody you know that you're a car guy, first of all, and let everybody know you like to find old cars, which will either end your conversation immediately, or it will, people will say, what do you mean you like to find cars? And you tell them, well, you know, there are cars sitting in people's garage and people's backyard. And I totally believe that everybody knows somebody who has an old car somewhere. And it might even be them, might be their father or their next door neighbor. But I think everybody could be a lead for your next discovery. And you know what? If it's not a Ford or it's not a Mustang, that's okay. Go there, pay respect, nod your head, be nice. And maybe that person knows of somebody with a Mustang in the garage, if that's the car you desire.
It definitely sounds like networking a bit and never closing a door to an opportunity to look at a barn find or a car opportunity like that. Like you said, you just don't know. You never know where it's going to lead, because those will also sometimes make the best stories. How that came about, how I did. I, like you said a minute ago, you're looking for a Porsche. Next thing you know, you're talking to the guy who's got a GT350. You just never know what you're going to find. And that's the cool part. That is just too cool and such. And so.
And you know what? The most valuable thing you'll find is a friend.
Yes.
I contend that car guys, car people, guys and girls are all friends. Some of us just haven't met yet. And, you know, the best thing that can come out of, you know, meeting somebody new that shares your passion for cars is that you've got a new friend that you can meet, you know, for coffee now and then and share stories and, you know, share leads on discoveries, things like that. So it's a cool world. And it's not only about the discovery, it's about the hunt.
Absolutely. You know, before we moved up to the Concord area, I used to live in a little community in North Georgia. And one day my wife and I were driving down back to home, and in a gas station, I see a GT350, early model. And I go, well, I don't know of that car. I don't know of any early GT350s in this town. So I pull over and I go to the gas station. And of course, you know, I got to talk to the guy. And we're talking about 10 minutes, 15 minutes while he's filling up the tank. And he sits there and he says, no. He says, I did. It's a tribute car. I built this. He said, but he says, this little town has some really cool cars. And I said, oh, yeah. And he says, yeah. He says, there's mine. There's another guy in town that's got a Boss 302, a newer, this was back in 2010, 2013 model. And he says, then also, we've got, there's a Shelby, there's a GT500 in this town too. Says, for our little town, you know, we got some pretty cool cars. Well, what I didn't tell him, because my wife was honking the horn because she wanted to get going, was that the Shelby was mine. And the Boss 302 was my neighbor's. And so I'm sitting there in our little subdivision. We had two really kind of cool cars. In fact, he used to work for the Ford truck division. He retired. And as his retirement gift, he did buy himself a Boss 302. So that was kind of cool. But so I go back to the car. My wife says, How can you just pull over and talk to a guy like this? And I said, all you have to do is say, it's really simple, sweetie. You walk up and you say, cool car. And the guy is going to talk to you. I mean, yep. That's when you know you're talking to a car guy. If a guy doesn't want to talk to you and you say that, turn around and walk away, because he's just not the right guy to talk to, so to speak. You know, he doesn't maybe necessarily get it. He may be more about he has a cool car and you're not kind of attitude. So I agree with you. And that's why we love it, the museum. We get a lot of folks here and we make a lot of friends. We really do. And we appreciate them and their cars and how they continue the heritage of Mustangs in our case, of course. So I know you mentioned you just did a book. What are you working on next?
Well, I've transitioned from books about barn finds, the Cobra in the barn, whatever, which I love, but I've done, you know, a number of those, to road trips. And sometimes those road trip books are barn find related, and sometimes they're not. And so the most recent road trip book I did, it's called Ford Model T Coast to Coast, A Slow Drive Across a Fast Country. And I drove a 100-year-old car from New York City to San Francisco on the Lincoln Highway, which is a 100-plus-year-old road, the first cross-country road in America. And I love the trip. It took 2 weeks driving a Model T at 35 miles an hour. Did not have one mechanical failure. It was just an amazing trip. So, okay, how do I top that? Driving a Model T from coast to coast. So I'm about to embark in the next few weeks. Ford Motor Company is loaning me a Bronco. One of the new Broncos. Airstream Trailers is loaning me a very small travel trailer. Haggerty's involved. Griot's Garage is involved as sponsors, and some clothing companies. And I have a charitable component as well, which is our Animal Rescue League. And I'm going to drive this rig with my photographer, Michael Allen Ross. We're going to drive it from Key West, Florida, which is mile zero on US 1. To the Arctic Circle in Alaska, which is the end of the road. So we're going from mile zero to the end of the road. It's about just under 7,000-mile trip. And cutting right across, diagonally across America, staying off the interstate highways, meeting people who live kind of off the beaten path, not near interstates, not near Walmarts, not near Petcos, and just kind of trying to meet the people and see the things that are these days so often bypassed. And I'm excited as heck. It's going to be 4 weeks from Florida to Seattle. Then I'll take 4 weeks off. And then 4 weeks from Seattle to Dead Horse, Alaska, which is literally the end of the road in the Arctic Ocean. So that's what's next in my life. And I can't wait to hit the road.
Wow, that sounds so ambitious. That might be the end-all trip of all road trips. I mean, how do you top that?
It's the longest trip an American can make point to point. You go through Canada, through the Yukon Territory, and go through British Columbia until you get back to Alaska. But, you can't. That's it. It's the end of the road.
Yeah, well, I'm sure, of course, you're going to have to make sure you do it during when the weather is at its best. Because obviously the further north you go, the little bit more dicey your travels can be. So, and I'm sure you're going to be able, will people be able to keep up with your travels? Are you doing things to, you know, how are you kind of keeping folks involved or engaged so they know how your trip is going?
Well, we're putting it all together now, but Haggerty is going to be take the lead on media. So we'll do video and we'll do Facebook and Instagram. Regular feed, so people. I want to get people engaged in it before we leave, during our trip, and then following the trip, keep people kind of energized on it, because the book will take about a year to get in people's hands. So the book would come out sometime in 2023, and I just want to, you know, keep people kind of engaged in that whole thought process.
If there's anything we can do as you get information or things you can share, we'll be happy to post it on our website, post it on our email blast and social media, because this sounds like something that I think a lot of people would like to just kind of, you know, keep their eye on, as it were, because this is something that's just this is beyond a bucket list. This is just like incredible. So hopefully you'll keep us involved.
Well, I'm 68 years old, but I'm a 14-year-old at heart. And so, you know, this is the kind of thing that would have excited me as a 14-year-old, and it excites me still today.
That means you haven't lost the passion, obviously, so that's great. I appreciate the time, Tom. I know we this goes by so fast, and I'm sure we can talk so much more about other things. So I really, but again, I do really appreciate you spending some time with us and sharing your stories. And please let us know how things are going, because we'd like to let people know, you know, especially on your upcoming trip and other things, you know, like with books or whatever. Let us know, because we're here just trying to help spread the word to other car enthusiasts and car guys. And so I want to thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thanks, Steve. I look forward to seeing you again.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to another episode of the Mustang Owners Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you won't miss any episodes. For more information on the museum, please go to MustangOwnersMuseum.com, and you'll find additional information on upcoming events.